Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Bon appétit. Welcome to the Adelot Second Tuesday Cafe series on the topic of global Swarthmore research across borders. Bon appétit. I am Karine Yervasi. I am in French and Francophone Studies. I am also the interim coordinator in Black Studies. And with my colleague Aisha Kai in Political Science, we are also the co-coordinators now of Global Studies. And as always, I'd like to begin with thanks. So thank you to the Adelot Foundation and especially to Pam Shropshire for making the series successful both in front of and behind the scenes. So thank you. Aisha and I are also especially grateful to our first cohort of graduating seniors who are embarking on this new minor in Global Studies, a program that in fact inspired this cafe series. Or are putting together that program really inspired this. So as I've mentioned, Aisha and I proposed this cafe series as a way to showcase what we learned from the many conversations we had with over, I think, 60 colleagues, is that about right? Yeah, with over 60 colleagues, about what the concept of global meant to them and how global studies could be envisioned here on this campus. Throughout this cafe series, we ask speakers to reflect again on what global means to them, their discipline, their research, and their work. So today, I would like to introduce Professor Pallavi Chakravorty. She comes to us today to speak about yokings, yoga, dance, and healing. I'm really excited for this talk. She will be presenting from her new project on yoga performance and healing. It's interdisciplinary work in combining medical anthropology and physical practices. And so Professor Chakravorty comes to us from the Department of Dance, so you might think that this is a little bit different from, say, her earlier research on Kathak, which is the classical dance form from North India, or on dance reality shows, which she wrote about in her book, This Is How We Dance. But in fact, Pallavi's work centers on the concerns of movement, so be it dance, performance, or physical practice, or even in her community-centered arts organization called Courtyard Dancers that aims to make dance works for post-colonial modernist voices. So understanding the vitality of the performing arts, she tells us, and the importance of that to all societies and their connections to the humanities and social sciences, and now medical anthropology as well, is what makes her really an exemplary critic and practitioner of what it means to be truly global here at Swarthmore. So please help me in giving a warm welcome to Professor Chakravorty.
Thank you, Karina. What a wonderful summary of my work. Thank you so much. And thank you, Karina and Aisha, for inviting me to present on this cafe series. I'm, of course, very excited to be presenting today, and thank you all for coming. You know, I know the weather is really beautiful outside, so. I want to tell you first that this is very preliminary. I am just exploring the possibilities of yoga and performance right now. And this is, I have no conclusion, and the paper that I will be presenting to you will be extremely exploratory. I'm very open to questions. So before I start, I just want to tell you a little bit about my introduction to yoga. I grew up in India, I grew up in Calcutta, so of course I was introduced to yoga as a child growing up there and also as an adult. I finished my undergraduate degree there. So it's nothing new for me, but what I am engaging with right now is absolutely new. So I am engaging with yoga as a scholar and also as a student, and the status of yoga is very new in the world right now. So I'm going to sort of do a little bit of a history of that and then go on to talk to you about what I'm interested in looking at. Yoga simply means to connect. I'm interested in exploring the intersection between yoga, dance, and healing, and the emergence of a hybrid intercultural body that is both artistic and scientific in contemporary culture. there are multiple trajectories of transnational yoga. These trajectories weave the history of dance in India with the history of dance in the US, and both with physical culture movements, health, and healing. The confluence of physical culture movement in India and the wider world, along with the renaissance of what is now called postural yoga, which is itself a new term, paved the way for universalizing the yoga body, both as cultural, national, transnational, and global. So my question is, what is this yoga body? I attempt to untangle some of these crisscrossing narratives that created yoga as both art and science, dance and neurobiology. In the process, I show its acultural and universal status and claim back its Indian roots as it circulates the globe. Mark Singleton argues that to a large extent, what we practice today as asanas or postural yoga emerged in the first half of the 20th century. It was a hybrid product of colonial India's exchange and assimilation of the worldwide physical culture movement, which included the launching of the popular physical culture self-instruction genre. Incidentally, the staging of the first modern Olympic was also around the same time, which coincided with the publishing of Vivekananda's Raja Yoga in 1896. And this is key to the modern yoga revival in India and around the world. Vivekananda's call for national awakening through the teachings of Vedanta and yoga in colonial India also included the reconstruction of masculine vigor among the native population. Yoga and Indian nationalists like him posited that yoga was going to develop the bodies, characters, and souls of the Indian people that had been emasculated by the colonial rule. The development of physical body with national character echoed across many chambers, and even women such as Sarala Devi, who was Rabindranath Tagore's niece, that is, poet laureate Rabindranath Tagore's niece, campaigned for the building of health and vigor among the youth through martial arts, yoga, and physical culture. The key figures of yoga as part of the physical culture movement in India were Manik Rao and Thiruka. The latter studied with the renowned figure of yoga renaissance in India, Swami Kuvalayananda, who is the founder of the experimental Kaivala Dhyama Yoga Institute and Research Center. He established it in 1924 in Lonavala, Maharashtra. This is where he carried forward his scientific research on yoga with human subjects and brought yoga closer to Western medical science. In fact, it's so interesting, even yesterday I was looking at a talk that was announced from Jefferson University, where a student of Swami Kuvalananda was actually doing this talk with a researcher who's working with cannabis for pain. You know, they're talking about yoga and healing and pain together, and his name still comes up, you know, in the global context. So just want to show you some images of these very important. The scientific claims of yoga was not only part of the international physical culture movement, but was also part of the international spiritual movement around the turn of the 20th century. The work of Theosophical Society in India by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky from 1886 is key here. The teachings of the society mingle Darwinian ideas of human development or evolution with concepts of karma and reincarnation in Hinduism, especially derived from dualistic Sankhya yoga. Sankhya is one particular tradition, yoga is another particular tradition. They come together in Theosophical Society's work and also in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which is what I'll be talking about. Blavatsky, along with Vivekananda, published on yoga by reviving Patanjali's Yoga Sutra based on Sankhya Yoga, and was responsible for infusing indigenous cultural knowledge with Western rationalism. The influential political and spiritual leader, Annie Besant, who became the president of the Indian National Congress and fought for home rule against British, also the president of Theosophical Society, was responsible for deeply establishing theosophical thought in India. She recruited Rukmini Devi Arundale, the pioneer of India's dance revival, to head the society after her. Rukmini Devi brought yoga and classical Indian dance on the same platform by imbuing both with Brahminic ideology. The intersection of classical Indian dance revival and the revival of yoga in India is a fascinating subject of appropriations and erasures. And this is what I actually accidentally landed on when I started looking at yoga, that how closely it matched the revival and regeneration and reformulation of what is called classical in Indian dance. The magnificent iconography of the dancing Shiva, invoked by Rukmini and other cultural revivalists, brought the two traditions together, where dance became yoga and yoga became dance of life. And these are some of the concepts that are attached to it. So this is a figure of dancing Nataraja or Shiva, and obviously, you know, comes from Indian dance traditions, or rather the dance traditions that we have called classical, actually symbolically attributes to these kinds of images and iconography. And the other picture is from temples of India, and there are many of these sculptures in temples, and this particular figure is perhaps something called Yakshi, or someone called Yakshi symbolizes fertility, goddesses perhaps, and they're also called Sala Bhanjika. There are many ways of, Sala means just hanging onto a tree, so they just come, you know, they are represented in temple sculptures. And some people argue that, oh, perhaps they are also doing yoga. I mean, you can just look at these images, you know, image after image or sculpture after sculpture, you see these things. Of course, scholars have said that perhaps not. I mean, these are not yoga meaning asanas, perhaps not. Is it dance? Now, scholars, some art historians have said, no, it isn't dance either. So some kind of movement, posture. So the yogic dance of Shiva found its expression in the writings of the renowned art historian A.K. Kumaraswamy, and later elaborated and theorized in classical dance by Kapila Vatsayan. But both in dance and yoga, the importance of establishing a golden age and classical, read Brahminical heritage, became the call for the nationalists to claim an independent Indian identity. And there have been many critiques of this as how Indian ideal national identity actually represents the high caste Brahminic identity. And of course, ignoring the other identities of the Dalits or the lower castes and the Muslims and the Buddhists and other, you know, religions in India like Jains. In order to establish such a narrative, both yoga and dance had to be removed from the degenerate practitioners of the colonial narratives, such as the courtesans, fakirs, and the sadhus, and raised to the status of Vedic classicism. A case in point is the tribal group known as Kalbelia in Rajasthan. They are traditionally snake charmers and dancers associated with the caste yogi. They are also practitioners of yoga and healing, but do not belong to the high caste Brahmins, and thus are not associated with classical yoga. The removal of yoga from the lived practices of the sadhus and fakirs that included low caste Hindus and Muslim Sufis. So what I am arguing, but scholars have argued as well, is that yoga was not just Hindu, it also incorporated Muslim Sufis. And its promotion through Vivekananda's Raja Yoga not only made yoga a spiritual pursuit, but elevated it to a high intellectual status. This elevated status of yoga could no longer include the tribal and backward castes in India, nor the Muslim practitioners, not unlike the exclusionary history of classical Indian dance, which is what I've looked at previously. So this is basically, you know, I had mentioned these people, Rukmini Devi, or Arun Dale is the, she's the pioneer in reviving classical Indian dance. And her club kind of dance is called Bharatanatyam, which is from southern India. And Annie Besant is a very important figure I had already mentioned in terms of both the Theosophical Society and Bharatanatyam and her relationship with Rukmini Devi. This is Madame Blavatsky. She's the founder of the Theosophical Society, and she spent many years in India. She also wrote a book on yoga, or many books perhaps, on yoga, and very much part of the yoga renaissance in India. Now we come to the sadhus. You know, yogis are also called sadhus in India, especially in the Hindu context. And these pictures are contemporary yogis or sadhus. And this is a picture, of course, these are all from the internet. I haven't done original research on this. But this particular image is of the Kalbelia caste that I'm talking about. They are Rajasthani folk dancers. Now they have become very popular among tourists. But you can see that obviously they were not part of the, at least right now, they're not part of the yoga narrative, but of course they're very much flexible with their bodies. So whether it is an asana or posture is the debate, right? Whether are these yoga postures or asanas, or are these just contortions? Is this gymnastics? Is this dance? But certainly something to do with the body. The revival of classical Indian dance from indigenous practices was also promoted by modern dance pioneers in the US, such as Ruth St. Denis. The turn of the century Oriental dance practiced by St. Denis and others was a synthesis of Asian-inspired techniques of transcendentalism, theosophy, Vedanta, and yoga. Singleton quotes Matthew Allen to explain the symbiosis of yoga and Indian dance and Western modern dance, where they are all players in a, and I quote, a drama of appropriation and legitimation with a pan-Indian South Asian framework of nationalist aspiration and cultural regeneration. Ruth St. Denis founded the Society of Spiritual Arts in New York and the New York School of Natya with La Mary in 1938. Her approach to spirituality and physicality was through her study of Del Sarte technique. Del Sarte, between 1811 and 1871, this is his lifetime, was interested in how emotions are physically expressed in the body and categorized them in charts and diagrams. His technique was later named harmonic gymnastics and popularized by Genevieve Stebbins. Stebbins performed her own interpretations of ancient dance on stage, and St. Denis, Ruth St. Denis, was inspired by seeing her as a young child. Stebbins' book on Del Sarte theories, titled The Del Sarte Systems of Expression, which was published in 1885, became a hugely successful publication in the international market. Singleton writes that some of Stebbins' deep breathing technique are connected to pranayama or yoga breathing, as practiced by Brahmins. Through Stebbins, dance and yoga becomes intricately associated with Western modern dance, which is later taken up by St. Denis and mingled with classical Indian dance. So this is where it becomes an amalgamation of various different dance forms, which is what is modern American dance. Ruth St. Denis's creations, such as East Indian Notch dance and Radha, are expressions of such Orientalist imaginings. Dance scholars, can you hear me? Yeah. Dance scholars such as Vatsan. Great, thank you. So this is, of course, Del Sarte, and these are some of the sketches, the Del Sarte technique that I'm talking about, and each of these postures are supposed to express some emotion. So he connects movement and postures to emotion. He was very interdisciplinary, so you see, he's just going to go ahead. And this is the picture of Genevieve Stebbins. Her harmonic gymnastics is supposed to have highly influenced yoga, what we know as yoga or asanas today. Again, this is very controversial because then it takes yoga away from India and indigenous roots of what we see today. But definitely her contribution is very much there in terms of what is called modern yoga. And this is Ruth St. Denis. As many of you know, she is an American modern dance pioneer. So dance scholars such as Vatsayan has theorized about classical Indian dance, movements, postures, and gestures by analyzing temple sculptures. The dancing figures of these temple sculptures show that many of the postures resemble yoga asanas. On the other hand, contemporary scholars of yoga have argued that the proliferation of postural asanas, where what we see today in yoga practice, is a development of recent times. As a dancer myself, I've often seen the similarities of Virasana with the movements and grounded stances embodied by mythological deity, Hindu deities like Durga, Kali, in the image of Shakti. One might argue this to be a tantric root of yoga. That's another trajectory, a thread that I'm not exploring here. However, what is relevant here is the work of contemporary dancer choreographer, the late Chandra Lekha, who used the philosophy of Sankhya Yoga and the tantric body of the Purusha and Prakriti The Purushan Prakriti concept I'm not going to go into, but this is basically the what was revived by Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, this concept of the human bodies. Prakriti is the desire or the matter, and Purusha is the soul, which is different than what is most commonly known as Advaita Vedanta, which doesn't see the binaries at all. This is a very binary Hindu philosophical thinking. In her dance piece, Sharira, this is Chandralekha's piece, Sharira, which literally means the body, a number of asanas merged to be performed on stage to express the feminine power of Shakti or power. She wanted to bring Indian dance back to the physicality of the body rather than superficial spirituality. She emphasized the role of prana, that is the force. Prana is the breath that people use during pranayama. The life force or the hatha. Hatha is force. In hatha yoga, in the regeneration of the mind and the body. Her yoga practice in conjunction with Bharatanatyam, which is a classical Indian dance from southern India, Rukmini Devi or Rundel, your image you saw, she was the one who kind of revived this form from ancient sculptures and colonial courtesans. So classical Indian dance style Bharatanatyam once again re-established the Vedic roots of yoga, but within the framework of physicality, such as asana practice rather than spirituality. So this is Chandralekha, and she's almost like, what you would think about is the Indian parallel of Merce Cunningham, perhaps, around the same time, 1980s. The asana practice gained visibility in classical and contemporary Indian dance now, but differently situated than the past. It was now having a conversation with postmodern or contemporary Western dance in the reformulation of dance, somatics, and the body, as started by the Judson Theatre, who actually pioneered postmodern dance in America. Here, the body is recognized for its biological and corporeal existence. Soma literally means the organic body, which includes the body and the psyche. And dance is not just art, but an aspect of lived experiences and movement in relation to others. The dancing body is like other bodies, anatomically understood through senses and perceptions and touch and psyche, and not just through the visceral means or aesthetic means. It is both aesthetics and aesthesis, writes Fraley. According to Fraley, dance was to engage with an embodied consciousness that would include Eastern perspectives of the body, such as in yoga and Western phenomenology and neurobiology. However, this perspective is not new in the anthropology of the body and the psychological anthropology field. The importance of the senses and the touch connected the physical body to its regeneration and rehabilitation through therapeutic means. The importance of prana or breath or awareness as a method to achieve health and healing was highlighted through the rediscovery of the yoga body that began with rationalists such as Vivekananda and firmly established by Kuvalayananda and others. In this new understanding of the hybrid body, the ancient knowledge of the body through chakras, kundalini, shushuma, these are the yogic understanding of the body, is not rejected but is merged with the medical anatomical body. Joseph Alter compares this new reconfiguration of yoga and medical body as a cyborg after Donna Haraway's the Cyborg Manifesto. Maybe some of you are aware of that article. So this is the yoga body, or how the body is imagined in yoga. And some of you might be familiar with these concepts of chakras. It's supposed to have, the body supposed to have this chakras, and kundalini is what is supposed to rise to the head as you become enlightened. And the chakras are also called lotuses. And this is from a painting. The first one is from a painting where the chakras are, represented in a very artistic way. And the one to your right, sorry, left, it's basically trying to look at the anatomy, the medical and anatomical body, and finding correlation with the lotuses or the chakras. So where do I come into this picture? So this is basically the general layout of the debates and the controversies, as well as the regeneration of yoga in India, through nationalism and now around the world. it's a very interesting, topic, I think, yoga, because it right now in India, it's been appropriated with the right-wing Hindutva movement, because they say that yoga is basically the property of the Hindu right-wing. In this country, there's a whole discourse on yoga and race, because yoga is practiced by the white upper-class elite, and it's not, democratic. And in fact, there is yoga studies department or a program, in Berkeley, where people are presenting papers on this subject. So it's very interesting, of course, where yoga is today. And of course, I'm not even mentioning the huge amount of corporatization that has gone into it, that it's completely corporate product, and people are being trained to become teachers. Every day there's one, something in the New York Times or somewhere, some other newspaper about what's happening with yoga. So a lot of people claiming to be gurus or sadhus, spiritual leaders, which is not new in America. This has happened, many times. So it's in a very interesting crossroads, I think, yoga right now. I entered my yoga research through Iyengar Yoga in Pune to heal a disc herniation in my neck that was going to put me through a complicated neck surgery. Mr. Iyengar, or Guruji, as he is referred to by his students, is the most prominent and brilliant man of modern yoga. He's the student of Krishnamacharya, who is credited to have blended asanas with physical culture, practice, and gymnastics. Iyengar Yoga uses a particular method of pulleys, props, and blankets to achieve the benefits of asanas for all practitioners, regardless of their expertise. His methodology also emphasizes the importance of alignment and symmetry that brings it close to dance. Rather than going in depth about the contribution of BKS Iyengar in creating modern yoga and his role in popularizing it in the wide world, I will focus on my own experience of working with one of his senior most disciples, Gulnaz Dasti. Through my own personal experience in Pune this past summer, in an autoethnographic mode, I will share how I became conscious of my own physical body through what is known as swa-adhyaya, or own practice or self-study. Through this experience, I found glimpses of the generative body that is both agentive and resourceful, but also limited and vulnerable to pain and suffering. A little bit about Gulnaz Dasti, my teacher. I found her absolutely interesting because she breaks all the stereotypes associated with yoga. She's not Hindu, she's Muslim, and she's obviously white. She does not fit into the usual yoga representation that you see, in the wider public. So it was very interesting to work with her and her relationship to yoga, which is another story. So these are from my ethnographic notes. Gulnaz's white hair frizzed around her forehead in a riot of white curls. Her voice is hoarse from a cough, but she's focused, practicing on her yoga mat when I enter the class. She tells me she's ready to work with me. I'm nervous, yearning to learn and absorb as much detail as I can. I'm also slightly apprehensive of the poses. What if they trigger pain? Gulnaz has a supremely confident approach to the body and the benefits of asanas. She explains in detail what she's trying to achieve with my body. She jokingly admonishes me for overtaxing it with pounding my feet, spinning, and dancing. She knew my dance style well and where the body can be damaged from long years of practice. She tells me what happens with aging naturally has been intensified by the process in my case. Now the alignment has to be readjusted. She's always super confident. The pelvic area has to be opened up. She goes over the standing poses one by one with me. Trikonasana, Virabhadrasana, Uttanasana. These are taught using various supports and props. I begin from a ballet-like bar and work with various wooden structures that make it easier for me to execute a particular asana. But alas, it is still difficult for me. All the details of the right and the left hand stretching over the bar, the placements of the bricks, the slow removal and addition. In the meantime, my knees keep giving up. My buttock sticks out and my thighs cave in. She addresses the arch of my lumbar and says, "See how much you have curved it." I respond that it is through my practice of Kathak. The arch reveals the beauty of the geometry of the body. She smiles and says, but that is unnatural. My heels and knees had to be pushed back and rooted properly on the ground. Gulnaz explains that the grounding has to come so that the spine gets attached to the tailbone. The entire lengthening can happen only then. She says yoga is all internal. Some say it is like gymnastics, but it is not. It is about striking difficult poses and being flexible. It is about internal connections and it is about internal connections and understanding the internal architecture of the body. I feel stretched, pulled, twisted, and released. I feel my neck is joining the torso. The cervical is joining the lumbar and my limbs. My spine seems to be coming together. Another day, I lie on the yoga mat. Gulnaz adjusts my body and turns my neck on the right and then on the left. She reminds me that I have to come to the center. I hold the toes and she says to lift the body, the torso upward. I go with my spine towards the sky. She says, go higher and dig into your heels. She continues, arch your back, tuck your buttocks, make your thighs tighter, and up you go. My head and neck are on the floor as I raise my torso. I try to cling to her every word. I remember vaguely my learning through my body when I was a young child. I was preoccupied with the tala system, the rhythmic structures, the eyes and the hands, the wrist and the stomping and the turns. I was preoccupied with the edges of my body, my feet, my palm, my fingers, and the emotional connection to the expressions of the song, the recitations of the rhythms. That was Kathak, a classical Indian dance from northern India. This was different. Yoga was austere. It was about focusing on the minute alignment of the thighs, the buttocks, the spine and the muscles, the nerves and the bones. This is the bricks and mortars of the physical body. The breath has to be found and used as a force to get to the asana postures. The breath had to be conscious, and this was new for me. I regularly attended Gulnaz's medical yoga class. I observed, learned, and tried to talk to the people taking her classes. I spoke to a woman who comes in with terrible pain. Gulnaz says everybody has pain. It is how we deal with it. The woman sits on a chair. Gulnaz works with her hands. She says, breathe and exhale. The woman groans. Gulnaz prepares with tools, bolsters, and blankets for another of her patients to lie down. Then she puts weights on the body. The class quickly turns into a hospital ward with patients with different ailments of the mind and body. They have great faith in Gulnaz, Iyengar, and yoga. I have read that yoga journey will ultimately leave one with the Anamaya Kosha, that is the gross body, to Siddhi, the liberated body or the subtle body. So you leave your physical body to enter a spiritual body. Here in the medical class in Pune, nobody seems to focus on that, rather on the mundane aspects of having a functioning body and a functioning mind. And I just want to end with some of the pictures of the hospital ward or the medical yoga class. Sorry, this is a picture of Mr. Iyengar. And of course, I think many of you are aware of his contribution to yoga. And this is Gulnaz Dasti, my teacher. And obviously, she's an amazing teacher. And she is now the senior most teacher in the institute, in Iyengar Institute in Pune. And this is the medical yoga class. You can see that Iyengar uses props and pulleys to work with the patients. And this is Gulnaz working with all the patients here. And this was a regular thing in the Iyengar medical classes. And so many people came from all over the world. It's not just from India. And many of them came to train as yoga teachers to teach in many different places, again, all over the world. Many came for physical and mental reasons. So that's my talk, and I'll open it up.